Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. Most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Morato.
And this is an official RTRFM podcast where we share our weekly edition of Movie Chat, as heard on Breakfast with Taylor every Friday morning, 7:30 a.m. on RTRFM 92.1. And we cover streaming releases, we cover cinema releases. At the time of recording, these are both in cinemas, and they are very divergent in terms of genres and maybe artistic rigor, who knows. But, you know, we are looking at a horror prequel called Orphan First Kill that follows up the adventures of Esther, the orphan introduced in the film Orphan from 2009.
So The titular orphan.
So I'm looking forward to talking about that later in this episode. But we start things off on a more, proper or critically worthy territory with a documentary that you talk about.
That's right. And I don't want to dispel the critical worthiness of Orphan : First Kill, but we are looking first up at a movie called Fire of Love about married volcanologists and their incredible treasure trove of footage taken right at the feet, at the face of active volcanoes.
This is Katya, and this is Maurice. Tomorrow will be their last day. They will leave behind hundreds of hours of footage, thousands of photos, and a million questions. Alone, they could only dream of volcanoes. Together, they can reach them. They meet on a blind date at a cafe. From here on out, life will only be volcanoes, volcanoes, volcanoes.
It is 7:30 on your Friday morning. It is time to check in with the squad for Movie Squad each and every week. Tristan, good morning.
Hello.
Simon, how you doing?
I'm so well. How are you?
Doing very well. Very exciting weekend ahead. I'm going to need a moment of recovery after In the Pines. Nothing better than sitting on the couch and watching a movie. Something that maybe you can help me with
or
this week.
Or in the theatre seat, in these instances.
Well, yeah, this week we are heading exclusively to the cinema. Both films up for review are showing, and we'll get to them both in a moment. But Simon, let's kick off with Fire of Love.
Yes, this is a movie that opened last week, but we really wanted to cover it. It's a new documentary from Sarah Dosa, and it follows the lives and travails of Katia and Maurice Kraft, who were married volcanologists. So they were obsessed with and in love with, if you will, volcanoes. These incredible natural, not phenomena, because they looked into how they were caused and what made them such literally seismic natural instances. Now, Taylor, are you the kind of person who's like, if they can find out a way for it to be safe, I will spelunk into the mouth of a volcano?
No,
are you interested in getting up close and personal with them?
No. For a couple of reasons. One of it, that requires like a lot of hiking up a volcano.
Yeah.
You can't just be like airdropped Mission Impossible style into it. So, no.
Not a live erupting one.
Well, you know, no. No,
okay.
I'm not.
What about you, Tristan?
Tristan?
Do you have an appetite for volcanoes?
Only if Pierce Brosnan is involved. I recently watched or caught up with Dante's Peak back in the era when it was Dante's Peak versus Volcano at the cinemas. But I don't know if I'd ever want to be close to a volcano or be in its perimeter. It is one of those kind of, you know, slow moving dread kind of ideas of, you know, being close to something that if it was active, potentially explosive and destructive. I've not seen this documentary, but I did watch Into the Inferno a couple of years back, which is the Werner Herzog documentary, which I believe is a Netflix film. It's still on Netflix. And I don't know, I'm trying to remember, because there's so many different people he talks to in that film. if the couple who are at the center of this film get a Guernsey in that one. But I do remember, I think there's one point, someone who lives in a town that's close by a volcano and it's active, and there's this footage of this guy going, well, it's coming, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to sit here and wait. I think that was the vibe of just like, if you're living close to, if that's where you live, then it's a different relationship to those who might be scientifically exploring it and potentially, you know, almost getting close to the fire in a sense.
Well, that's really interesting. And you brought up a few things there that do tie into Fire of Love, which could have been a Werner Herzog film. Mm. As you say, it's not so dissimilar probably from what is it, Into the Inferno?
Into the Inferno.
Into the Inferno, yeah. This one is narrated by Miranda July, who's the filmmaker and performance artist, and has a much more warm and inviting tone to her. But she does talk about the kind of unblinking nature of Mother Nature. And uncaring would be the wrong word for it, but basically indiscriminatory carnage that a volcano can wreak. But it does involve these two people who love each other, who love these volcanoes, and who ultimately sacrifice their lives in pursuit of getting closer and closer. And that is revealed in the opening moment of the film. They did perish in 1991. And the movie ultimately tries to get to the heart of, well, why did they get so close to ultimately perish in the shadow of an erupting volcano? And it uses almost entirely archive footage that Katia and Maurice Kraft filmed themselves. So it is one of those really compelling archival docos. It's not a talking head kind of essay movie. It is very much using existing footage that they compiled. And firstly, it's a wonderful way to package up these spectacular shots they gained of the red volcanoes, so the ones with lava kind of bubbling and burbling and the tectonic plates making the molten lava rise, and then the grey volcanoes, which are the killer volcanoes. They're the ones that just from our perception look like grey smoke clouds, mushroom clouds, but ultimately are the ones that, you know, closer in are just rocks firing everywhere. You know, they are the ones that are causing the most carnage. So we get to see that fantastic footage recompiled by director Sarah Dosa. But again, trying to get to the heart of why they would go to these lengths, what was driving them. And what we discover is that it's because they were filmmakers. And that's what I find really compelling about this movie. They had this passion for volcanoes, Katia and Maurice Kraft, but they also understood what they could do, these volcanoes. And the more they studied, they helped develop how you could evacuate safely, you know, kind of what you were talking about, Tristan. And in many instances would go to a village or go to a town and say, hey, you are at real risk here. You need to have an evacuation plan. In one instance, the village or the town says, nope, too expensive. The country, ultimately, the government says that. And a village is wiped out with 25,000 deaths. Wow. And so they understood from that point forward, they had to get closer and closer to really capture the horror that these volcanoes could convey. And that became their life's mission. It is spectacular to look at this film, but I do love that angle of you know, the movie at a certain point sort of pivots and goes, let's look at them as filmmakers. Let's watch them composing shots, restaging shots. And it becomes a bit of a mix of the Werner Herzog-style documentary and like the work of Mark Cousins, who made The Story of Film. And he makes these fantastic kind of collage movies about filmmakers. Taylor, are you interested in these Natural Geographic-style docos? It is a Natural Geographic film. Have you been one to, you know, happen upon them and stick with it on telly, or do you kind of go, I need it to have more of a hook than what they do?
You know, I don't. Like, I'm not a nature documentary kind of person, even narrated by the best of them. I'm usually one just to sort of flick over it. This is interesting, though, because it's like it's their life's work in two different ways. It's their body of work as filmmakers, but also as lovers of volcanoes and volcanologists. So it's interesting to see, I'm curious to see how those two things come together. You mentioned that like it pivots halfway through the film. So while I'm not a nature documentary fiend, this does pique my interest.
Yeah, and I think it covers a lot of bases. It is, if you want to see really incredible, really cool volcano footage, it looks unreal. I mean, Tristan, earlier this year, we saw The Northman, which yes, climaxes sir. With a naked Alexander Skarsgård and Claes Bang fighting in the mouth of a molten volcano. Mm. This looks better.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. Because, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, in terms of some of the advertising imagery, it is, you know, that river of fire and someone just like standing in a silver suit. And you just think that is, I mean, that possibly can't do anything for you if you even get close to it. So, yeah, I mean, that footage and that kind of being, you know, so close to something that is could kill you and wanting to film it is very, very arresting. I'm interested because I've not seen this film. I do want to catch up with it. But I think about documentaries in this day and age and the glut of them, particularly in streaming platforms and television documentaries and the room for film documentaries. And I think the thing I always think of streaming documentaries is that they just take too long to get to the point. Do you think this film kind of achieves what it does in the right amount of time? And also that other point that, you know, you could make a Werner Herzog documentary about this subject matter. How would you describe the difference here?
Yeah, first of all, it's 90 minutes, folks. We love it. Yes. We love it when it's 90 minutes. So it really does get to the point and covers, like I said, a lot of bases. Werner Herzog has more of a meandering style, and that's one of the pleasures of a Werner Herzog film. This is very different. It doesn't have an essay structure, but it has a clear argument, which I always love in a film like this. And when it does become about them as filmmakers, again, I don't want to say it becomes a movie about filmmaking, but anyone with a little bit of a background or knowledge or appreciation of film, and certainly French cinema, will see like, oh, they were kind of influenced by the French New Wave, or maybe there was a combination of influences back and forth here. Also, I will say that Katia and Maurice and their sort of crew, their expedition crew, they all kind of dress the same. They wear these like cozy knits and these red beanies. And you have to wonder, along with... Jacques Cousteau, were they influencing The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou? It has that kind of incredible look to it. And they're such funny characters. And Maurice, in particular, has a real way with words. I wrote down one of his descriptions of his life's mission: a kamikaze existence in the beauty of volcanic things. And to hear these French existentialists reciting their sort of their love for or their appreciation for the earth is incredible. So it is a very focused film. That's the difference. It does have, I don't want to say it has heart because that makes it sound cheesy. Even Fire of Love, I think, is a terrible title and not really fair to the film inside of it. But Miranda July and the structure of the film, it has a real, and I apologize, I am going to say warmth.
Okay. All right.
I can't find another. That's why they went with Fire of Love. How do you leave that on the table, I suppose? But this is a really compelling, really beautiful movie. I think one of the best of the year. I'm not a fan of the Talking Head documentary. I'm not a fan of the streaming docos, which are basically just PowerPoint presentations. This is cinema, and I loved it.
All right. High praise from Simon this week for Fire of Love.
Welcome home, Esther. We left it just as it was.
It's lovely to be back. I miss my family very much.
Our goal here is helping Esther acclimate back into life within the family unit.
Sorry.
We are changing pace. We're going to talk about Orphan First Kill.
Yes, Orphan First Kill. So we go from a documentary, you know, taking in the wonders and the awe-inspiring sights of nature to a film made to capitalize on the success of a horror movie from 2009 to almost build a franchise out of this idea of an evil kid movie called Orphan First Kill. Now, this is a prequel to a film called Orphan from 2009. And this is the thing. When that film came out, I didn't see it, but I heard it had a twist, and I just wanted to spoil it for myself, so I read up what the twist was.
Oh, Tristan.
I know, I did. But I was just like, I don't want to sit through it. And I read the twist, and I was like, that is a wild and wacky twist. So I feel like I want to dance around that, even though the film is a decade old. But I only saw it for the first time, Orphan, the first film, last year. And yeah, I had a lot of fun. It was a wild ride. It's a very demented movie. Sometimes you look at older films from the 70s, 80s, 90s, you think, they could never make that today. This is a film made in 2009, and there are scenes in that you think no one would even touch making that scene now. But this is a major Hollywood production with great actors in it, Vera Farmiga and Peter Sarsgaard, and a great lead role for child actor at the time, Isabel Fuhrman. Now, yeah. Have you seen Orphan, Simon?
I saw Orphan in cinemas and didn't know the twist, and then the twist happens, and you're like, what? And the only thing more shocking than the twist to Orphan is the fact that there's now a prequel.
Yes.
Which you would think would be almost impossible.
Yes.
Because of the context of that twist. Wow, we're really dancing around it now, Taylor. And I apologize. But yeah, really enjoyed Orphan at the time. Really fun. And you describe it as a hit, and I'm sure it must have made a lot of money for them to make a prequel, and it probably had a long tail on DVD and streaming and what have you. So there's clearly a business case to be made. But it wasn't a zeitgeist-devouring movie at the time, and it certainly exited my memory beyond the details of the twist.
Yeah, so it is interesting to come back to it, but I think it's one of those, the long tail, like, I think it's grown a little bit just because of its kind of just demented quality and coming back to it, like I did last year for Halloween season, seeing it for the first time. Taylor, did you see it when it came out?
Yeah, I did. And I feel really bad because it was one of those films that came out, I would have been about 14 or 15.
Oh, right.
So I put it on with a group of friends and I don't remember what the twist is.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, that works
well,
great.
I'm just being polite here, but like, you know, if you read any plot descriptions of Orphan First Kill, I'm sure they tell you what the twist is. And in the first 5 minutes of the movie, they don't dance around it. They explain what the deal is with
Esther. Well, they have to, right?
Yes.
It's a prequel.
With Esther, played by Isabel Fuhrman. So the other strange thing about this film that I was very curious about is, it's a prequel that takes place before the events of Orphan from 2009, and it's the same actor. So when they played Esther, they were a child actor. Now Isabel Fuhrman has made other films, including a film I've not seen called The Novice that you would recommend, Simon?
Yeah, it came out this year. I don't know if it's got an official Australian release yet, but that is fantastic, and she's really good in it. But as a woman in her early 20s.
Yes, she's
like... Or mid-20s,
She's around 25, so she's playing this character who is a child. So you're like, how is that going to work? And apparently it wasn't her idea, but the producers were like, you know, this we can make it work. So what they've done basically is they've dressed her up as a child. They film her from, you know, strategic angles. There's a behind-the-scenes shot going around of the other actors wearing kind of like...
Giant boots.
Stilts to kind of... To measure the height dynamics. And then I thought it was going to be really wild and wacky, but it's not too bad. But it's still, I mean, the obvious thing is her face is an adult's face. They can't, you know, they can do makeup and soften it with CGI, but it's an adult's face. But the most, you know, glaring instance is when they cut from her close up looking up at an adult actor, and then they cut to a wide shot and you see that it's a child stunt double. You know, it's like, so... Okay, got to get your head around that. But this is the type of movie where I'm sure it really doesn't matter, because following on from the first one, this is a horror movie, but it kind of deals in a little bit of camp and trash. It's following up with the earlier exploits of Esther, this orphan who we meet in an asylum, who's been committed there for previous things that happened. So I will spoil that this film is called First Kill, but we don't actually see the first kill. This is the first kill before the events in Earth Orphan, if you want to get technical. Anyway, she's in a Russian asylum. She breaks out. She decides to pose as an orphan for an American couple who are missing their child, and is taken in and finds herself in a very kind of idyllic situation in that she's in this wintry part of America in this mansion with this wealthy couple who are played by Julia Stiles, who we all remember from Save the Last Dance and 10 Things I Hate About You, and Rossif Sutherland, who I wasn't sure. He looked familiar, and then I realized he's a Sutherland. He's a son of Donald. But they are this couple with an older child, a teenager, played by Matthew Finlan, who gets a great introduction in that we see him at a fencing tournament soundtracked by Interpol's Evil. So there's a lot of 2000s era vibes going on here. So they're a very wealthy, kind of privileged family, except for the husband, who's a bit of a kind of salt of the earth type. He's an artist, and he takes in Esther under his wing to show her the ways of making art. Now, there's another twist in this film that I don't want to spoil, but what was great about this and seeing it with an audience is how everyone reacted when it happened, because the film starts off in the similar path of the previous film, and then it pivots and becomes something else, and it gives something more for Julia Stiles to do, who's really good in this as well, and I enjoyed her a lot in this movie. And there are just a shift in dynamics that make this quite entertaining and engaging. Now, this is similar to Beast, which I reviewed last week, in that I had a good time watching it. I don't know if it's essential. I don't know if you need to buy a ticket to rush out to the cinema to see it. But if you're a fan of the first film, if you're a fan of evil child weird horror movies, then this is there for you. It's out in cinemas now. Now, Simon, you've not seen Orphan First Kill. Are you, like, I have to assume that the casting of Isabel Furman is, like, an intriguing element of how will this work in the film?
I will absolutely, in my lifetime, see Orphan First Kill. I don't think, as much as I am curious about everything, I don't think there's enough. You know, I haven't heard enough raves, and even your recommendation. It's the kind of thing where it's like, the second it lands on Netflix, everything else steps aside. You know, the second it lands on a streaming service, that's what I'm watching that night. That's my enthusiasm level. But to get me to go and see it, that's a bit of a push. I will say, I'm so glad they didn't recast. I love that they went with Isabel Furman. I want them to make another one in 10 years that's set before this one. And I think you got to keep doing that and keep making it trashier. Yeah. But it already is trashy. Who directed it?
Well, that's the thing. It's it's the thing. William Brent Bell, who I've not seen any of his previous films. He did make the film The Boy and the sequel The Boy 2, which I've not ever seen.
Brahms.
But yes. I love that you know the subtitle to that. but he's okay. There are certain moments near the third act where I wish there was a more of a De Palma stylist, because there are some kills that happen, but they kind of just happen, whereas I wish he would have made a meal out of them. But I don't know if they had a high budget. And this is due to land, I think, on Paramount Plus. I don't know if that's only international or here, but that's one of the co-producers, I think. Now, you can't remember anything that happened to the first film, Taylor, but Orphan First Kill does. I mean, you're not really into horror films, so this wouldn't would you do it for Julia Stiles? Are you a fan of her?
I am a fan of Julia Stiles. Maybe. How you sound like you're kind of disappointed with the kills in this film, which to me actually sounds like maybe that's a good thing. Like, are they not as intensely gross as the previous film?
Yeah, it's a bloody movie, but it's not. My memory of the first one, I don't think it's up to that level of violence. There is violence, but it kind of happens in a very, it feels like a streamer era kind of film, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it's okay. Like I was just disappointed that it could have been a bit more of a dramatic, operatic kind of, particularly where it goes in terms of the shifting dynamics in the family. But Orphan First Kill, it's out now. I don't know if anyone will see it, but if you're a fan of the first film, I think it's a decent enough follow-up, even if it can't really match just the craziness of the first film.
All right, needs more crazy, the takeaway, for me at least, this week. I'm not a fan of horror. I am going to see a horror film next week.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to go and see the Bodies, Bodies, Bodies film.
Yes, looking forward to that one.
Yeah, my review threw, like, slotted fingers in the cinema.
Oh, you'll be fine. It's one of those, like, tongue-in-cheek horror films, right?
Yeah, that's my speed, I think, for sure. Yes, this week, Orphan First Kill and Fire of Love. If you've missed part of those reviews, they'll be available online in the Movie Squad podcast and restream at the website. Tristan and Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
More Movie Squad back on your radio next Friday morning.
So there you have it. Two great reviews. I mean, this is a case where we have only seen, you know, the film. We both haven't seen them, but, you know, I guess we'll catch up with them at different points. I look forward to seeing Fire of Love.
Who do you think will see the other first?
I mean, that is a good question.
Because Orphan First Kill, you can be in the mood for that pretty much any time, right?
That is like a Friday afternoon flick, whereas like I think Fire of Love, it doesn't sound difficult to me, if that makes sense. You know, in the sense that sometimes you hear about a film that is very well reviewed and critically acclaimed, and you think, oh, I want to see that, but I've got to be in the right headspace for that. Whereas I could feel that you know, Fire of Love would be like a Sunday evening flick where I'd give it the kind of the prime time and make me start off the week in a good space. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. I did want to ask just your opinion, because I did, like, the only way I could connect with Fire of Love was talking about that Werner Herzog documentary and then my recent viewing of Dante's Peak. So the films that came out at the same time, Dante's Peak and Volcano. Have you seen both of those films?
I've only seen Dante's Peak. Which kind of, to me, I imagined it as the deep impact to Volcano's Armageddon. You know, it was the simulation compared to the arcade game, right? So Dante's Peak, I wasn't really a fan of. It's a bummer of a movie.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And I think as a, it came out in 97, so I was 9, I was like, oh my God, Volcanoes, you know, like where you think that's actually like a threat to you.
Yes,
They are, theoretically, depending on where you live in the planet. So it really bummed me out.
Right.
But how
right.
Where did you fall on the two of them?
Well, because that could be a series of its own, those moments, and particularly in that era where the films were going head-to-head with similar plots. And Dante's Peak, I think, pipped the post because that came out first and was more successful than Volcano, which takes a different tact by suggesting that there's a volcano underneath Los Angeles that erupts in the city, a little bit different to the usual expectation that it would happen in a kind of mountainous regional community. I'd like to revisit Volcano, but I remember it. I mean, they're both kind of very trashy. They're not like, you know.
No. One of them wasn't actually more robust than the other, we'll say.
I will say it always sticks out to me that there's a moment in Volcano that aims for a little bit of like social political commentary in that everyone's covered in ash and a child character says, "Daddy, daddy, they all look the same," which which is a great utopian idea at the end of a very trashy disaster movie.
Yeah, but nothing spells utopia to me than active volcano in the middle of a bustling metropolis.
But yeah, so well, we could answer that question another time. I think because I saw Dante's Peak recently, and I'm more appreciating the 90s era Pierce Brosnan, I think I'll go Dante's Peak, even if it is a bummer that the kind of the climax of the film is just them stuck in a cave and having to get out, which is not quite a rip-roaring,
But we should also say that neither of them hold a candle to Joe vs. the Volcano, if we're talking volcano movies. And I don't know that many more than the ones we've cited. These may be the five volcano movies out there, unless I'm really blanking.
The one that comes to mind was the, you know, Irwin Allen, the producer who made the kind of the big disaster movies in the 70s, like The Towering Inferno and The Poseidon Adventure. I think at the end of his run, made one about a volcano with a very older Paul Newman called When Time Ran Out. I remember seeing that on TV as a kid, and it doesn't really hold up to those classics of the genre. So yeah, and Joe versus the Volcano. Joe versus the Volcano. That gives me another reason to press click on it, being that it's been on my binge watch list for.
Have you not seen it before?
No, I've not seen it.
Oh, Tristan. Meg Ryan plays three characters, and they are all hilarious. And Tom Hanks,
yes.
Look, there may be some questionable stuff in the last third, some otherization that maybe hasn't aged very
right.
well. But the film as a whole, I did love, certainly, when I watched it. I revisited it when it kind of got its reacclaim, lost classic. It is the forgotten Tom Hanks Meg Ryan collab where they get to be really broad comedy geniuses. So
yeah.
I highly recommend it.
Well, that's a great recommendation.
Dan Hedaya is in it.
You've sold me even more. Dad Hedaya with Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. I'll have to watch it this very weekend. So thank you so much, Simon. And thank you to Taylor for having us each and every week. And we look forward to sharing more opinions, whether the movies feature volcanoes or not, in the future.